Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. Today I'm joined by Gerard Brady, Chief Economist with IBEC, to give some insight into the COVID-19 crisis from the viewpoint of industry. We've heard a lot of numbers over the last few weeks, but it's also important to understand what exactly are the underlying problems facing industry, the problems that are driving these figures. Among the measures discussed, Gerard emphasises the importance of liquidity supports for industry. It's important to note that this conversation was recorded just before the Irish government announced additional liquidity supports. So while this and other points highlighted by Gerard are as important as ever, it is worth bearing in mind that a number of additional liquidity supports have come on stream in the last couple of days. Gerard, it's great to have you on board here to discuss what exactly is happening from an industry perspective.
Thanks for having me, Niall. Very much appreciate it.
No worries. Okay, so maybe we could start off by just discussing when things were kicking off, what would be the signals coming from industry initially? What sort of struggles were they facing?
So what we've seen so far kind of mirrors the labour markets. In the labour market, there's 500,000 people now on the COVID payment. There's 200,000 who are already on the live register, and then there's another 130,000 and growing on the wage subsidy scheme that the government have put together. And if you think of that, it's one in every four people of working age now reliant in some way on the state for their income. And it broadly actually reflects, the labour market reflects from what we are hearing from members. So 2 weeks ago, I suppose, what companies were asking us is, how long will I stay open and how will I pay my staff? The answer to the first question, most of them have received by now because they've got the list of essential and non-essential companies. We've looked at the numbers on that, and about 35% of people worked in companies that are fully closed after the publication of that list. A little bit more than about 40% work in companies that are limited in some way. So either part of the sector is open and part of it is closed, or they work in a services company where the office might be closed, but they're working from home. And then you've got about a third of workers, a lot of them in the public sector, who are working in companies that are fully open or organizations that are fully open. So the calls we've gotten that in the last 2 weeks reflected that. Then there were a lot of questions about how will I pay my staff. A lot of people saw this coming down the line over the few weeks, a closure coming, and they're asking, how am I going to pay my staff when turnover drops? The wage subsidy scheme deals with part of that. And now the questions have turned to two things. The first is, how long will I stay closed? Is a massive question, because the economic impact of this crisis is all about the public health measures. It's not like the 800,000 people or the vast majority of them who are on income supports now are there because we have made a decision, the right decision, to take public health measures and put public health first. How long those measures stay in place and whether people stay at home, whether we can flatten the curve, actually really matters for the economic outcome. And then the second question that they're asking now from members is, when will I get paid? Because a lot of people haven't got paid by the people they supplied to in the first quarter of the year. They haven't got paid by those people that they supplied to. And so you might have a company that sells into restaurants or hotels, for a food company, for example. A lot of those companies haven't got paid for things they have already supplied. And those that are getting paid, I suppose, are paid or are getting paid on timelines that they had never planned for. So the next question that comes for pretty much every company, big and small, we're seeing it across our membership, where the question is, how will I pay my bills? Still wages, even in the services sector, which is heavily labor intensive, still about 30% of the costs, excluding the kind of input costs that you have, the kind of fixed costs, rent, insurance, utility bills, all make up 30% of the total costs of the business. And a lot of companies now are looking at those costs and saying, well, I can't pay them because I have no turnover. And that's kind of where they stand. And that's across almost every sector and across companies of all sizes. You know, companies in good shape in normal times who just, no one has a plan for 100% drop in turnover.
So how exactly does the shock being experienced at the moment compare to that experienced in 2008?
In a normal recession, what you usually see is companies start to lose turnover over a period of about 6 to 9 months, that you might lose 10-20% of turnover. In a bad recession, that's the kind of thing that happens. What's very different about this recession is that it's very different even than extreme recessions. So the most extreme case we can think of in recent Irish history is what happened to the construction sector during the aftermath of the bubble bursting in 2008. The construction sector, even at that time, and the velocity of that loss was just enormous, was a 50% loss in turnover over the first 2 years. What's happened to a large chunk of companies, about a third of the workforce or a little bit more work for these companies, is that over the course of less than a week, they've lost 100% of their turnover. So when you have something like one in four people of working age working for one of these companies, and then this recession happens over the course of a week, where you have really large fixed costs left outstanding. So in a normal recession, if you know that next month your demand's going to go down, you can adjust. You can talk to your landlord, you can start to talk to revenue, you can start to talk to people who are going to be who you're going to owe money to at the end of the process, and you can start to work it out and adjust your business model. When you lose 100% of your turnover in a week, there is zero time to adjust. And that's what we've seen over the last week, 2 weeks, is that an awful lot of people are working in companies who have had no time whatsoever to adjust. And recessions are a function like distance of velocity and time, right? This recession is so different than a normal recession in that the velocity is really, really much quicker. It's not 6 to 9 months, it's 2 weeks. And what really matters now is time. How long does this recession go on for? And those public health measures, which are crucially important from a public health point of view, the longer that they are necessary, and they are necessary, the longer that they're necessary, the worse it gets, the worse that the longer people spend at 0% of what they planned for in terms of demand. And it's very, very difficult when that goes on for a long time without some kind of support from outside for companies to start back up again. Because what happens, I suppose, is that, you know, your wages are taken care of under this wage subsidy scheme, but it still leaves you, even in services companies like a restaurant or a pub or retail, with about 30% of your costs, things like insurance, rates, rents, which all still have to be paid for, even if you are shut down.
So there are many scenarios for recovery once the COVID-19 crisis is brought under control. Some people refer to a quick return to economic activity, a V-shaped recovery. But as time goes on, I think there's a creeping expectation that social distancing will be here for a bit longer than originally envisaged. The general discussion seems to be centering around the gradual reintroduction of economic activity. And my interpretation of such a gradual shift is that the likelihood of a U-shaped recovery is more likely. How are businesses shaped in such a context where recovery is gradual and perhaps supports are not in place to deal with that?
I suppose the point about this velocity question and the 100% loss rather than a kind of a gradual loss of 10, 20 or 30% turnover to 100% overnight is that businesses have no plan, no way of adjusting. They're basically in, like people have called it a deep freeze, but it's worse than that in that while they're in the deep freeze, the turnover has gone to zero. And it's very difficult for a company to get out of that. So V-shaped recovery, I suppose, is only possible if there's more liquidity support into the economy. It's not just about companies going to the wall, which they will. Like we expect there will be a spike in liquidations over the coming weeks because a lot of companies might hold 3 weeks cash, particularly in the SME sector. And when your turnover goes to zero, and you still have outgoings, maybe 30% of your costs are fixed costs that are still there and you still have to pay them. You just can't survive for long. And even for those companies who do survive, they might open their doors in a month's time or 2 months' time, whenever the public health measures or the need for them subsides. But it takes a long time for those companies to bring customers back because, you know, the behavior of customers will change and people will be cautious. It takes time to restaff. It takes time to replace any suppliers which you've lost because suppliers might go to the wall. And then what we've put in place, I suppose, so far, a lot of the supports are about a deferral strategy. It's about putting things off for a couple of months so that companies have some breathing space. But that can only be the first step to ensuring that that a recovery takes place as quickly as possible. Because a lot of companies, and we see it coming down the line, when the public health measures end, because we've chosen a deferral route rather than a liquidity route in terms of the policy answer to this, when the crisis ends, the first knocks on your door, before even customers get as far as you, will be the suppliers that you owe money to from the first quarter of the year who you haven't paid. There'll be your landlord, your bank, utilities, the local authority looking for rates, and indeed the revenue commissioners. So there's a lot of companies out there who have gone into this, have gone to zero turnover and face a wall of debt when they get out of it. People they've owed money to and has been deferred for a while. So I think we've been saying from a policy point of view, you have to be able to give people the space by giving them low-cost loans, by giving them more solid deferrals from a tax point of view and rates, by looking at credit guarantees that you allow people more structure, more time to work these things out, and it allows them to work them out in a kind of a structured way. What we're doing at the moment probably is that we're going to store up our problems for a couple of months until this passes, and then we're in for a slow, difficult, fractious recovery where people are fighting with the revenue, with their landlords, with the utilities, because they don't have the money to pay straight away. And that means that the idea of a V-shaped recovery is out the door without supports put in place.
So when you said deferrals, you mean postponing payments till they're back in business, basically?
Yeah, and that's kind of what we've been doing as a kind of a first line of response is to postpone things. But postponing things doesn't really work in the long term, because when things go back to normal, you have low margin businesses who are starting to only recover from a period where they had no turnover, and they have lots of outgoings that have been accruing and that they're going to have to all pay at once or over a period of time. And it just makes it a lot more difficult for companies to start to invest again, to start to plan for the future, or even just get back into business.
So most economists would agree that the textbook solution to a crisis like this is for governments to spend, to offer supports for industry and households. And there has been considerable supports offered in Ireland to date. So most commentators would probably expect more support to come online in the coming weeks. And few would argue against the fact that this is probably necessary and the right thing to do. But I know you mentioned additional liquidity supports, but can you give us some further insight on the types of supports that industry need right now?
So I suppose we've kind of said there's four, I guess, buckets of policy. There's four kind of ways that you can help with that liquidity crisis. The first is low-cost loans. The argument for that and an overarching argument for all of this is that the NTMA raised 6 billion euro, which is about the cost actually of the proposals to the Exchequer in gross terms. Now in net terms, they'd be paid down to maybe 3 or 4 billion after loans are repaid, but about 6 billion euro they raised, and 0.25% was the interest rate on that borrowing. There's a way of thinking about this back in 2011 where you had 6, 7, 8, 9 and higher interest rates at the point where you were making policy decisions. It's difficult to make those policy decisions. It should be easier now because when interest rates are that low, when the cost of borrowing is that low, it's almost impossible to do too much. But it's very, very easy to do too little or to underestimate the scale of the crisis that's out there. And it's very clear to us talking to members, the scale of the liquidity crisis is enormous. So there's four things you can do. One is this idea of low-cost loans. If the state can borrow at 0.25%, but the interest rate facing companies out there in a normal kind of borrowing environment in the economy is 4 or 5%, even with state backing at the moment, like it doesn't make sense. So we've said, look, the state can lend to companies and lend at fairly low interest rates, even if it's just for a 12-month period that the interest rate is low and it goes back to normal afterwards. The second thing that the government can do is that it can make sure that the private sector continues to provide products that are necessary by putting in place guarantees. So one of the things that happened in 2008 is that credit insurance for exporters, the market for that in the globe is dominated by 5 companies. And those companies started to withdraw basically from the market because exporting became very risky because you didn't know whether you were going to get paid. That will more than likely start to happen again. And it means that Irish exporters can't, particularly SME exporters, can't take the risk of sending product abroad. So the state can step in there with a guarantee. The same for things like invoice financing and even for just normal new loans or refinancing of existing debt that businesses will need to do when they're restructuring because of the crisis. The third piece that we can do, and we are doing some of it in a kind of an ad hoc fashion. We know companies are talking to Revenue all the time about maybe if they're not able to pay their VAT that is owed or they're not able to pay some of their bills to Revenue, that they're finding out new terms or negotiating new terms. But you can put that on a kind of a more formal and more official footing. And you also need to do similar things about rates, which are so important for a lot of SMEs, particularly kind of local retail focused SMEs. And then the fourth is small firms. We see this in Germany and the UK and elsewhere. Really small firms aren't going to take on debt because they can't afford it. They're not capable of dealing with very complex financial instruments. So what the German and UK governments are doing are basically just giving them cash. They're saying, you've been a good taxpayer for a number of years. You're not going to be a good taxpayer probably this year, but in future, we hope you will be a good taxpayer again. And this year, we're going to give you some money instead. And the German government, for example, are giving small firms, very small firms, about 15,000 over a course of 3 months to basically pay the fixed costs for them in the hope that they survive and then continue to pay taxes and pay that back in the future. And so there's kind of four ways that you can deal with it. In total, we've costed those measures at about 6 billion gross. Once loans are paid back, it's probably 3 to 4 billion. You're talking about 1-1.5% national income. And when you're facing a drop that could be anywhere, we've seen numbers between 8% and 15% of national income and GDP, it's not a huge amount of money. And as I said, because borrowing costs are so low, there's a much bigger danger of not doing enough than there is of doing too much.
How much in addition to what's currently on the table would you envisage?
Yeah, so we can look at a good measure of this. The European Commission have put in place a new a new state aid framework. So state aid basically regulates how much governments can give to businesses in terms of supports for research, in terms of supports for working capital or anything else in between. Those state aid rules are usually pretty strict because they don't want governments benefiting their own domestic companies too much. But for the purposes of this crisis, they've essentially given open rein. So you have countries like Germany who have been given permission to give up to $1 billion to individual companies, never mind to sectors or to the whole economy. What we're seeing across the economy is about an EU average, and these numbers coming from the Commission, about an EU average of fiscal supports. Direct fiscal spending is about 2.5% of GDP, and Ireland is in that space, with our wage subsidy scheme, with the measures put in place to support the health system, that we're doing the right things on those sectors. At a European level, liquidity supports then, so guarantees, loans, those kind of things that we're talking about for business, are closer to 16% of GDP. Even mid-sized countries, the likes of Portugal, have put $13 billion behind this. Sweden, $9 billion. You look at even countries like Estonia have put about $2 billion behind it. Luxembourg and Malta are about $300-400 million. So we're probably late to these kind of supports. Our hope is over the coming weeks, and really is a matter of weeks, because liquidations and businesses will go to the wall very, very quickly. This is a really fast moving event, that the government will take advantage of the state aid rules, low borrowing costs, and the fact that the European Commission have also paused, the European Council have paused the European fiscal rules for this period to allow people to do exactly this. And it's all about SMEs, actually, for the most part, and mid-caps, that the ECB have extended their purchasing program of commercial paper to large corporates. And there's a lot of money behind that, a wall of money there to buy commercial paper of corporates, short-term debt to fit their liquidity needs. And it will meet their liquidity needs in a lot of cases. So then if you get down into mid-caps and small companies, those guys are the ones who really, really need the support from the government, because they're not going to be getting it from the monetary system, or they're not going to be getting it quick enough. The best examples we've seen, I've talked a little bit about Germany. Switzerland actually has done fantastic work in this space. It's a bigger economy than ours, but not by a huge amount. And they've put $20 billion initially of support out there for SMEs, and they've extended that to $40 billion now in recent days, of the exact same types of measures that we're talking about 6% of GDP that they've put behind that indirect supports and direct measures, and they've got it out really, really quickly. So companies are getting approval in 3-4 days, and at pretty good terms, close to zero interest rates, state guarantees up to of 100% up to $1 million, and about 85% up to $20 million of borrowing. So really, really strong measures in place. And a lot of these needn't cost money unless people default on them. Things would have to get really, really bad for this to cost the government any more here than maybe 1-1.5% of GDP. So from our point of view, and listening to our members, it makes a huge amount of sense.
If I was to be critical, one thing that comes to mind is that you're comparing a lot of GDP, percentage of GDP in Irish GDP versus maybe what they're doing in Germany as a percentage of German GDP. But imagine, for example, the structure of the economy is very different. So there, for to them, industry is perhaps, like maybe manufacturing industry, would be much more important than it will be here. So if we went with the equivalent, well, then it seems like a windfall for a lot of industry.
I think if you look across the sectors, it's not just, I think in the initial sweep of sectors that were impacted by this, it was very much focused on hospitality, on retail, and particularly the what they call non-essential retail, the everyone bar pharmacies and grocery. And it was focused on place sectors like construction. But actually, large chunks of manufacturing, large chunks of the broader economy are all going to be impacted by it. So the makeup, the mix of the economy doesn't really matter. I've heard the argument, which, there is some truth to that, GDP in Ireland is a different denominator. But even if you put it in GNI Star, it doesn't change it that much. You've got this enormous risk And if things aren't bad, right, the measures that we talk about in terms of guarantees and loans, if things don't turn out to be that bad, well, the government doesn't lose out because the guarantees never kick in and the loans get paid back. On the other hand, if things do turn out to be very bad and you've been waiting to do things slowly, to wait until things were very, very clear and you could see the macro numbers before you take action, well, then the damage will already have been done. So if you wait 2 or 3 months and this becomes about going from income supports for households and you skip straight towards reboot, the view we've taken, and I think it's right, is that the reboot, the less you do in the midpoint for liquidity for SMEs in particular, the more expensive the reboot becomes. That you're going to have to give a lot more in terms of a fiscal boost to the economy, in terms of public investment projects, in terms of supports for individual sectors to get the economy back up and running again when this all ends, if you haven't done enough to support the economy in the midterm, while the public health measures are in place. So the way I think about it is this, no matter what route you take, you're not saving money. This is a big, deep recession. I've talked about velocity. It is an enormous downward velocity in the economy over a very short period. And if you don't take the right measures at the outset, you're going to end up paying for them at the end. And if you don't take the right measures, then you might have to spend a bit less at the end in terms of getting the economy back up and running. And that's the choice facing policymakers. There's no cheap or easy option. And without those supports put in place in the midpoint while we're in these public health measures to keep SMEs alive, well, then there's not going to be enough taxpayers to pay taxes. After this recession is over, there's not going to be enough companies there to hire people back into jobs. And your V-shaped recovery turns into a U-shaped recovery with a very long, drawn-out bottom to it.
So let me first say that I'm pretty much in agreement that the solution is to keep the engine running through supports like those that you propose. Definitely, we need to act quickly, and it's better to act quick, maybe spend less precisely and carefully, than to have a perfect plan in place, but then implement when it's too late and ineffective. If I were a cynic, one criticism is that we are keeping firms on life support and are creating an expectation that they will be kept alive by the government if they cannot keep themselves alive. There's now an option to fall back on this support instead of finding a way out themselves. I'm not saying this is likely, and if I were to do some empirical analysis, I'd probably find that there'd be a very low propensity to act in this way, but to maybe cut off all the doubters before we even get to making these sort of criticisms, is there a way we can build in a fail-safe in these sort of supports to minimise the chance of this happening in the first place?
Well, one thing you can do, and I'd be sympathetic to that argument in a normal recession, right, that you're not going to keep companies alive who are, I guess, become zombie companies. This problem that people talk about, I'm not sure what the scale of it actually is, because you have disagreements over what a zombie company is, right? But that the state ends up supporting companies who should have gone out of business in a normal recession, and those businesses are weak businesses. There's no firm entry because incumbents are protected by the state, and then there's no firm exit, and it has a long-term impact on productivity, right? And it becomes a bad policy decision. But I guess the difference in this is that these companies aren't losing demand because they're bad companies. A lot of them are very, very strong companies in normal times. They're losing demand because the state has asked them to shut down to support public health. So when they come back, they should be still pretty well-run companies. They're not companies that would have gone out of business in normal trading times. And because this is so different, I think that argument holds a lot less weight in this kind of a recession than it would, say, if it was a normal kind of business cycle recession, for example.
Sure, yeah.
Where you don't want to be picking winners. I think in a normal recession I'd be more sympathetic towards that, but in this recession, and particularly the kind of no regrets piece, there is a chance that this goes on for a month or 2 months and we get back not to normal straight away, because there's damage done And look, labour markets, you know, have long-term scarring no matter what comes out of this. And companies will have long-term scarring in terms of their risk appetite, investment profile, and consumers will have that in terms of how they're willing to spend or how they change their behaviour. But you can get back to something like a normal pretty quickly, and we'd be kind of confident of that because the business model was strong. If the public health measures work on a global level, things can get back to normal. Maybe not V-shaped, but a pretty sharp U. If, on the other hand, the measures aren't taken, the risk is that it just takes an awful long time, that what might take 9 months goes to 2 or 3 years. And in an environment where bond yields were, where the cost of borrowing was high, you would have a lot more to think about. The trade-off would be there for government, where they'd really have to think hard about what the costs or potential costs of this are. In the current environment, they can take that risk and really should take that risk because you don't have a huge amount of risk, a downside risk in the strategy of doing as much as it takes. And look, we've had discussions in Europe about corona bonds, about monetary financing, about lots of other things over the last couple of months. But fundamentally, it remains, because borrowing costs are so low and the ECB is committed to keeping borrowing costs low, it remains the gift of government still, despite all the other ideas out there, to do the right thing. And a lot of governments around Europe are doing the right thing in terms of liquidity supports. And we'll only see, I guess, that counter argument could be right. I think it's wrong, and I'd be fairly confident of it. But if it is right, we'll find out afterwards, because there is going to be a differential across different countries in how they approach the public health approach and how they approach the business support approach and the household support approach.
Sure. So if you had, would you have a lot of members who would perhaps, if this goes on much longer, they're going to say, well, we're going to the wall. What sort of industries are we looking at that would be most exposed, and what sort of timescales are we talking about?
Yeah, so we've talked to an awful lot of companies. I think in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been on, between conference calls and direct calls, hundreds of CFOs or CEOs of companies, big and small. And there's a general feeling out there, particularly low margin industries that are cash intensive. They need cash to continue to turn over, and they have pretty low margins, that there's going to be two waves to this. The first wave is companies that basically run out of cash quickly, particularly SMEs and particularly things like restaurants, things like small retailers, and those kind of companies who maybe at a maximum in a lot of cases hold about 3 weeks cash. They're going to run out of money very, very quickly, and they'll go to the wall quickly. The second phase of this is probably more longer term. It's about that wall of debt that I talked about earlier, that because we've deferred everything, these companies are going to have to still pay their full year's debts, but they're going to have to do it having lost a quarter possibly of turnover. And that means that you're going to have two things happen. One is that a lot of people aren't going to get paid what they think they're going to get paid. And that's going to cause difficulties. And it's going to make people more cautious with their cash, which freezes the economy up. And the other thing that's going to happen is that a large group of companies are at risk of going to the wall when things normalize, that they'll come back, they'll look at their balance sheets, and they'll see, look at all this debt we've accrued, we will literally never be able to pay it back. Now, they mightn't go to the wall straight away, but what it will do is that if you have a load of debt on your balance sheet, you have a low margin business, so particularly, as I said, retail, hospitality and others, so some manufacturing as well. If you have a load of debt in your balance sheet and you have low margins, what ends up happening is you don't have the wherewithal to invest, you don't have the wherewithal to grow, and competitors elsewhere in Ireland or outside Ireland in a lot of cases will eat your dinner because you don't have the capacity to do the right things for the business because you've got that kind of noose that is hung over from this crisis. So it the liquidity problem turns into a more longer term problem if it's not dealt with head on. And that's one of the big risks, actually, in terms of that discussion about a V-shaped versus a U-shaped recovery. We've talked to an awful lot of companies who are left with that problem when things get better, even if they do survive. So there's going to be talk from a household point of view about people who owe money because of the crisis. And that conversation is going to happen from a business community point of view as well. So it's going to be very, very difficult over the next couple of months to work that out.
You made a very interesting point there about it's almost like this can interact with international competitiveness, because some nations are given some support, some are not. And because the state aid rules have been relaxed, it seems that if some companies in Ireland are coming out of this, have experienced fewer supports than maybe German companies, there might be international competitiveness issues. So this could have a very long lingering effect in that context.
And I think that's the argument for dealing with it up front, right, is that there's costs involved, but there's a long-term cost of doing nothing. And because borrowing rates are low, the long-term cost of doing nothing is actually a bit higher than and probably a lot higher, I think. If you think of two companies, one has come out of the crisis, and they're, let's say, a German company with low-cost loans from the KfW or one of the German state banks. They've got low-cost loans. They've been able to restructure quite quickly, and they just get back to normal business fairly quick. And you've got a company, an Irish company, who hasn't got that support bidding against them, but that has a lot of debt on their book and doesn't therefore have the kind of capacity, because they're all low margin industries or a lot of low margin industries, they don't have the capacity to take on new projects. They can't build a new production line, because they can't afford to take on more debt, or they can't afford to take huge orders because they don't have the working capital to pay for the inputs to produce those orders. And the effective debt on the balance sheet of a lot of companies will have really, really long-term effects coming out of this. And if you think about losing a quarter out of a year, it's a really, really big blow to a company, in the same way as losing 25% out of a quarter would be to an economy. The wherewithal governments have to borrow to help finance the losses that the economy makes, most businesses don't have that wherewithal. Sure. And that's why it makes sense for the state to step in and basically extend its own balance sheet for a period of time to take on that challenge that a lot of SMEs have. Now there is a good argument that maybe the state should be careful, particularly when we talk about guarantees. Look, the Irish experience of guarantees isn't great. But there's something we're going to have to get over fairly quickly. And you asked about the time period we're talking about here. Like, we're talking, even talking to big enough corporates, actually, in recent weeks, who are in very exposed sectors, we're talking about weeks and months rather than just over a couple of, if this goes on till Christmas, there being trouble, we're talking about maybe a week, maybe a couple of weeks. And that's the big, challenge that we face. Speed is our perfect is the enemy of the good in a situation like this, where sure. The velocity of the recession is just so rapid.
So before we wrap up, we talked a lot in general terms. Can you give some insight into some industries that are perhaps most affected? I'd imagine, for example, if the virus left in the morning, luxury expenditures would be hardest hit. Have you any insight into the relative balance between the various industries?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see. No more than, like, the Irish consumer, just at a domestic level, came out of the crisis. And if you talk to anybody in the retail or that kind of consumer facing space from a company point of view, we have these discussions all the time. And the psychology of Irish consumers changed completely, where short term debts, credit card debts, were paid down and are still being paid down 10 years afterwards at a rapid pace compared to even most European countries. People don't want short-term debt. People weren't borrowing for consumption purposes, bar housing, and even were borrowing quite a bit less for housing. There was a big, massive change, and savings rates went up even in response to Brexit, savings rates jumped. So we've got a lot more nervous Irish consumer. You could see that definitely happening. Sectors that are most exposed. I was talking to someone the other day who runs a business in a coastal area. Tourism business, their season goes basically summer season. So it starts maybe March or April on a good year, and it ends basically in September when kids go back to school. That's how that how a lot of towns, particularly in the west of the country, stay alive over the summer period. What we're looking at now, if this runs on till August, September, then there is no summer period, and you get into a situation where they're waiting till next summer before demand picks up. So you can see certain industries that are seasonal, for example, fruit, veg, those kind of industries as well, where there's seasonality. And the cycle of this will really leave them in the lurch. I think it'd be a mistake to think that this is just about, it's just about shops and pubs and the things that are very, very visibly closed to us, actually. And it would be a mistake to think it's even just about the kind of consumer-facing sectors. So we've seen manufacturing companies who are, looking at lost demand, and because they're in the car supply chain, they're in airplane supply chains. We've got people who are impacted by the fact that how hospitals have changed their routines that they'd supply normally into hospitals for normal surgeries and operations that are happening. And they're not getting demand because hospitals are gone full time after the COVID-19. So everything from regional newspapers to manufacturers to aircraft leasing, all kinds of sectors that are impacted by this. And in the longer term as well, there's going to be changes in global supply chains and longer term impacts of this. So even if Ireland comes out of this in the next couple of months, you're going to see global supply chains impacted for well over a year because people are trying to rebuild what they're doing. Airline industry probably is and the travel industry in general is probably a very good example. Really long lead times. The actual airlines themselves are unlikely to be leasing planes, which flows the whole way down the supply chain to the whole way through that economy, all the way down to people who are sub-suppliers in manufacturing. So if you look at the Irish economy at the moment, there's about a third of employees are in sectors where they are closed, the sectors are closed, but there's a lot more who are in sectors which are impacted, and the long-term growth of those sectors and the return to normality of those sectors might not be in the form that it currently has taken. Even in the least impacted sectors, in areas like office-based work, where people are working from home, the world that we're going to step back into when this is over is going to be very different than the world that we're in now, in terms of people remote working and the impact that will have in the long term on commercial office, the commercial office market, on the construction industry, even on the demand for fuel and demand for public transport. So there's a huge amount of changes that could happen out of this because it is such a sharp, unexpected shock. On the other hand, if consumer behavior changes, people might be less likely to go abroad, and you could see domestic tourism pick up. So there's a lot of questions that will come out of this that will basically depend on how households react. And a lot of that is so unpredictable at the moment because nobody, like the main overarching feeling out there, I think, is kind of fear at the moment and some grief. But when this all ends and we start to get back to normal, my feeling is probably that that's going to take time, that it's going to happen in stages rather than one bang where we all go back on the train and on a Monday morning and go to work, you know. that's going to take a while, and that process is going to be really tricky for a government. If we have a government at that stage, it's going to be a really tricky thing to manage. So it might change lots of things. We've talked a lot about social dialogue, the kind of European model. It's not central wage bargaining. It's basically policy focused, trying to get social groups to talk about what kind of economy comes out of this. And no matter what happens, we won't end up with the same economy we went into it with. And that's going to cause us a lot of challenges, even from a globalization point of view. we heard comments from the US president in recent weeks, which were all about onshoring supply chains. There's going to be a lot of reactions out there in the global economy to this, which are completely unpredictable, not just from a consumer point of view, but even from a policy point of view. And it's going to make things over the next few years very differential in terms of the amount of change that's going to happen.
The tourism is something that would have crossed many people's minds, but fruit and veg and those sort of industries would be far from many people's minds. And it brings to light the importance of maybe household level measures and demand side measures to make sure people are back to their consumption patterns.
And I think what can't be underestimated, I suppose, is I've talked to people in professional services who have laid off staff. I've talked to people in advertising who've laid off staff. You can see what's happening in regional newspapers, for example, in terms of the layoff that, and even national titles, because the advertising industry has collapsed. When you see individual industries shut down and shut down so quick, usually, as I said, in a normal recession, they have time to adjust, and so do their suppliers, and so does everyone down the chain. The economy has time to adjust. What's happened this time is so different because there's been zero time for adjustment. It's just gone from 100 to zero overnight. And the sectors that you'd never really expect to be the first to be hit from this point of view, even the transport sector, is a major impact. And it's going to continue to grow over the coming weeks because the suppliers of suppliers aren't getting paid, and that's what makes this liquidity question so important.
Absolutely. Okay, I think we've covered pretty much everything. I know your time is precious. Thanks, Stuart, for taking some time, and I hope the listeners were able to handle two Longford accents in one conversation.
The two very rare Longford economists.
Yeah, I wonder if I go home and I start speaking to other people, I slip back into it, but hopefully I didn't go too badly here now today anyway. But thanks very much.
Okay, thanks very much, Niall.
My thanks to Jared for taking the time to speak with me. If you're enjoying the podcast, give us a shout out on Twitter at Irish Econ Pod. Tell your friends, and if you're an Apple user, a 5-star review makes all the difference. All the best.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.